Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. My name is Pascal Mies, and on Tech and Trees, I talk to climate tech founders, investors, and operators to learn about how we can build better climate tech companies and how we build more of them faster. On this episode, I talk to Natalia Dorfman, founder and CEO of Kita. Kita is an insurance startup from the UK that focuses on insuring carbon. Buying carbon credits comes with a lot of risk. This risk keeps large players with deep pockets from buying high-quality carbon credits. This is a hurdle to scaling projects and technologies that can contribute to slowing climate change. Insurance plays a big role in de-risking carbon markets and turning them into an effective measure to fight climate change. I was looking forward to this conversation as I know very little about insurance, and I knew that we were about to get into the technicalities of the carbon markets. So listen and learn from Natalia Dorfman from Kita. Enjoy.
Welcome to Tech and Trees.
Hi, Natalia. Thank you so much for taking the time and being here. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, awesome. Just to get started and get a bit of insights regarding, you know, your daily life, I would like to ask you, what does a typical day in your life look like?
I do have a relatively typical day. I suppose I have two young kids, and so my days tend to split between the days that I'm home and doing pickups and drop-offs and then the days that I go into the office. So the days that I go into the office are more varied, but I can give you a very specific routine for a day when I'm at home, which is I tend to wake up around 5:30, so I can do about an hour and a half of work before my kids wake up. I then take them to school, feed them breakfast, et cetera, from around 7 to 9. I always run home from school to get some efficient exercise in, and so I start working around 9:30. I tend to have lots of calls, particularly on days that I'm at home. I do calls with international contacts and clients. And then I do pick up, so I don't work from around 5 to 7:30, and then I do a bit of a tidy up at the end of the day. And that is a very, very much basically every Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Tight schedule. Do you think having kids makes you a better CEO, better founder overall? Are you more deliberate with your time?
I actually think probably yes, to be honest. So, I mean, I had kids prior to Kita. I started Kita when my kids were 3 and 6. So I had already worked in a large corporate environment, pre-children and then post-children. And I actually even then thought that having kids made me more focused, I guess, on the 80-20 rule. Like once you have kids, you can't just stay in the office indefinitely. And so I was always very focused on achieving what I needed to achieve while I was in the office and then not wasting time, because at the end of the day, I do like to get home and see my kids. And now I think with Kita, it's a balancing act because I do have a lot of work to do. And so I would probably say that I always end up working mornings, evenings, weekends. But then on the flip side, I think kids help me to stop working and I guess focus on the bigger picture as well. And at the end of the day, I mean, I don't focus on climate change solely because of my children, but it is a good reminder also that sometimes we need to put our egos aside and actually focus on the big problem that affects all of us, which is bigger than all of our individual companies.
Yeah. A lot of people, I feel at least, get into climate because of their children. Like you say, okay, it's partly because of them, but not solely. Can you take me back to the moment when you decided, hey, that's it, I have to do something about climate change, or I want to start a venture in this space?
Yes. I mean, I can take you back actually to that specific moment in relation to Kita, but my interest in climate change started well before that, to be honest. So I mean, we were talking before that we actually started filming about you went on a backpacking trip in South America. And, you know, for me, it wasn't a backpacking trip, but I just grew up outside. I grew up in Southern California. We were always outside, always on the beach, always hiking. Like, I just like being outside. I majored in environmental science at university because I thought I could go hiking. And so I went to university 2001 to 2005, and I majored in environmental science, and I studied the impact of climate change upon tree growth then. I went to Costa Rica to study abroad. I studied tropical field biology. And so I do often think, like, I was focused on climate change then, and it wasn't new by any means then. You know, people are already very, very much in specific subtopics within the wider climate change space. But then I never worked in climate change because I didn't like working in a lab. And so I suppose with Kita, I went on and I did other things in my career. I spent 15 years in the legal industry. I did business development and strategy at international law firms. But I always cared about climate in my personal life. I just thought that my professional life didn't need to be focused on my kind of like one point. I thought climate change was sort of personal and then work was more work, and I wanted to be intellectually stimulated at work. But then the two things came together. I was working at a law firm called Clyde & Co, which is a big insurance law firm. And over time there, I had become global head of new business. And as part of that role, I was leading the business development strategy for the firm's climate risk practice. And I remember there was a moment when I thought, I guess, A, that it was all that I wanted to do, and it was only part of my job at Clyde & Co. And then I thought, well, if I stay here and it's only part of what I do, I guess I had a moment where I thought, either with all of the information that I knew at that point, we'd gone really deep on the science and the regulations and everything that was happening in climate change space in around 2018, 2019. And I thought either I could work on the assumption that somebody else comes and finds solutions, which feels sort of scary being reliant on someone else, or I could try to wholeheartedly do something myself and spend 100% of my time on it, which obviously has a high failure risk, but then it also has the power of feeling like you're taking action. And so that's what I decided to do. And I think that was the moment when I thought I will spend the rest of my career focused on climate change. And then to be honest, it was just starting my own company was one of the options via which I could spend the rest of my career focused on climate change. It wasn't that I wanted to become an entrepreneur. It was that I wanted to work on climate change. And entrepreneurship is a actually a very good route to do that.
And you mentioned that you could take me back to the specific moment that birthed Kita, so to speak. So let's dive into that. How did Kita came about as this, you know, focus on entrepreneurship eventually?
So Kita came about, so that focus on wanting to work on climate change, the entrepreneurship came about. I got a post on my LinkedIn about Carbon 13, which is a venture builder for climate tech startups that now is also in Germany as well, I think in Berlin. But I joined it in its Cambridge chapter. And so it was a venture builder for people who wanted to do a startup, wanted to do climate change, but didn't have an existing team or an existing business. And who want to build a company that could remove, you know, millions of tons of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And so I applied to that as a sort of like a punt, let's see. And then when I was accepted, I realized I would have to quit my job and it was a real lifestyle change. And so I decided to do that. And then at Carbon 13 is where I met Paul and Tom, my co-founders. But the on my side, the idea to do insurance was really speaking to a lot of people who were building climate tech startups, and a lot of them are hard tech. And everyone had in their mind how quickly they were going to scale and have impact, because everyone knows you need to really have that impact in the technologies developed this decade. And I would always just ask them, because I came from this insurance background, from this law firm, I was always like, where are you going to get insurance for this? Or like, where are your investors or the banks? Like, once you move beyond VC money and grant funding, how are you going to get the project finance, and who's going to have insurance? How are you going to mitigate your risks? And A, it was always very telling to me that no one had thought about insurance. I think everyone just assumes they'll just get it. But actually, within the insurance industry, some of these technologies are so new and so specific that there's not general insurance available. And you need to work with insurance companies to develop this tailored insurance. And so I was aware that there wasn't enough insurance out there for many companies in the climate space. And this is still very much true. But I thought that there was a route to use my background to create an insurance company that was very, very specific and tailored, and that could be an enabler for others. So I remember I had this moment. I remember pitching it to the CEO of Carbon 13. I was like, I'm going to build a green insurer. And I was so excited. And he was like, okay, that's nice. And then I met Paul and Tom, and they had the skills to build insurance products. And so they agreed to work with me. I sold them on insurance, but they had also come into Carbon 13 looking at the carbon markets. So together we kind of combined our ideas into Kita, which is the carbon insurance company. So it wasn't like an overnight, oh, I came up with Kita. It was more, I had a little bit of a brainchild, I remember, of insurance, but then it was very much collaborative with Paul and Tom to get it to where we are, where we are now, obviously.
Yeah. And could you maybe flesh out that link between climate change and insurance for me a little bit more? So basically explaining what you're doing with Kita, right? Like, why do people need insurance in the carbon markets?
Yeah, of course. So I suppose I'll take it higher than the carbon markets first. So insurance at its core, and I would say most people listening to this probably have some form of insurance. Like maybe you have car insurance or maybe contents insurance for your home. And maybe you've had a bad experience with insurance, or maybe like travel insurance where they didn't pay you. I think this is the kind of normal insurance people think about. But when you get into the insurance industry, what you actually realize is almost everything is insured. And without insurance, a lot of things don't function. And so there was this great example. I was listening to a podcast from the CEO of Aviva, and she was giving the example of during the financial crisis, there was a large insurance company who was having some financial difficulties of its own. And this insurance company insured the majority of the world's airlines. And so if you think about this, if this insurance company goes under and the world's airlines are no longer insured, there is literally no plane in the world that flies without insurance, right? Things shut down. There's no ships that fly. There's, you know, no buses that go. When you look at, let's say, for example, things that seem incredible, like launching a satellite. And you think, how does anyone launch a satellite when it costs them millions and millions of dollars to put this thing together? And all it needs is one little miswiring to cause a big explosion. Like, who's going to put their money into that? And the reason, one of the answers is the insurance industry, because no one entity can put their money into that. No one bank is going to finance that risk. But if you spread that risk across many, many insurance companies, each of which you takes a small part, and then if that, say, explosion occurs, each of them pay out the claim, they enable the safety for the bank to lend and they enable the safety for the satellite company to build. And so insurance backs many, many things. But high level, people use insurance for three categories of reasons. One is because it's a legal obligation to do so. So for example, employer's liability in the UK, you must have it. Two is because it's a sort of part of doing business. It would be a red flag if you didn't have it. So I'd say, I don't know, getting a mortgage is one of these things. I want to get a mortgage on my house. Let's say I'm unable to get flood insurance for my house. Like, that is a red flag. And then the third category of reason often is the sort of the cost, capital efficiencies or the size of the loss. So if something is affordable enough to me that I don't mind if I lose it, I could replace it easily. Let's say my kids' bikes. There's no point in me getting insurance because I can just replace it off my balance sheet, no problem. But if there's something that's very important to me that I can't just replace off my balance sheet, let's say my husband has this fancy racing bike, then that's the kind of thing you buy insurance for. Because if you look at it from a capital deployment perspective, either I can hold back money, say on my family balance sheet to buy another racing bike, or, and that's like, you know, I don't know, $5,000 or something I need to hold back. That's a lot of money for me to hold back, right? I could be spending that money on other things. If I insure it, I take the risk of paying a small upfront insurance premium. However, the benefit of that is I no longer have to hold 5,000 pounds on my balance sheet. The insurance company is holding that risk for me instead. And so thus I can spend that 5,000 pounds on other things. You can extrapolate that into a business. If they have a risk that is so large that they couldn't cover it themselves off their own balance sheet, it just makes economic sense to pass that risk to the insurance company, and the insurance company holds it for them. So we'd call it risk transfer. So one, it frees up capital on balance sheets to deploy towards things that could grow their business rather than holding it back for a rainy day. And then two, and this is where it does get to be quite relevant for carbon companies, it can improve your cost of accessing capital. So if your risks are insured, you might get a better term on your bank loan, for example. Or if you're a bank or a lender, you might be able to access better terms on your debt. So it can be a real capital efficiency play for a lot of companies. And so when we work with carbon companies, whether the investors, the financiers, or the projects themselves, is helping them to identify those risks that are large enough and unlikely enough, your sort of outlier risks, that it doesn't make sense for them to hold back capital themselves. And instead, it makes economic efficiency sense to pass that risk to an insurance company. And so that is a conversation we have with a lot of companies. And that ranges from a, let's say, forestry company who might be planting trees in order to access the carbon credit market. And we'd be looking at them around their natural catastrophe related risks, as well as counterparty risks they might have with local communities, let's say, or people on the ground doing the planting, as well as maybe science risk around what if there's a methodology change, all the way through to your sort of more technological solutions that might have a supply chain risk or a machinery operational kind of failure risk. So both on the project developer side as well as from the investor side, who's taking the upfront investment risk but doesn't have control of the underlying project. And so we can look to insure them against the risks that they're, in essence, project performance. So the investor puts money into a project expecting carbon credits in return. And what happens if there's a problem with the underlying project, which means it doesn't meet those performance expectations? That's where our insurance would come in to protect that investment and mitigate the risk.
Yeah. Do you have as a company, preference for or against working with carbon removal? So like more technology-based companies or nature-based companies?
Projects companies. We don't actually really have a preference, to be honest. I'd say within our team, we have preferences this on an individual basis. I think this sometimes comes out within the carbon markets. But on the whole, within Kita, we are one of the view that actually within the climate space, where we are in the kind of climate change crisis, we don't actually have the luxury of really picking winners. You sort of need to be scaling up all of them. And so on that side, when you look at the science of the types of carbon removal and also the avoidance and sort of restoration projects that we need, we truly need all of the solutions we have available to us today. And then secondly, when you look at it from the risk perspective, they all have different risks. And I'm often asked if one is riskier than the other, but really you're looking at it just from different things. So nature-based projects do tend to be exposed to more natural catastrophe-related risks. But the technological type solutions tend to be exposed to more significant machinery failure or supply chain risks. For example, if there's a problem with a machine, sometimes the supply chains aren't yet in place enough to provide replacement parts. All of them might be exposed to some form of methodology risk from the carbon standards. And then likewise, they might share some country risks, for example, in terms of a political risk or a host country expropriation. And then finally, is actually very much in the best interest of an insurance company to build its own diversified portfolio in terms of what we insure. So we're not too exposed to one particular type of risk. So no, I would say we are of the view that one of the key premises of Kita is that we want to be an enabler to help scale finance to increase the high quality carbon projects out there. But we're not specific as to what type of projects those are. It's more, we will only work with those projects that we feel meet the definitions of quality. So they are doing good. They are not doing harm in terms of how they are removing or mitigating that carbon in the atmosphere.
Yeah. So you're essentially enabling the flow of more capital into carbon markets so that more projects can be scaled and more carbon can eventually be sequestered, ideally. Is that?
Yes, exactly. That is okay. More succinctly said than what I said. That is exactly what we try and do.
Because I am very much an insurance outsider, and when I have to deal with private insurance, then it's a mess. So I'm just trying to really understand what you're doing. I would be interested. Do you have, or is there a difference in, let's say there is a damaged party, right? So there's the case for you as an insurer to step in and pay out the damages that were caused, right? In this case, let's say, for example, a natural disaster occurred and burned down, a forest that was supposed to symbolize a certain amount of carbon credits, right? Or a certain amount of carbon. Like, is there a difference between paying out these damages in form of actual carbon credits? Like, do you hold carbon credits as a reserve or do you hold cash and then pay out cash? And is there a difference between the two? And if you could elaborate on this would be really interesting.
Yes, I think that is a great question. And I think that's a very live discussion within the relatively nascent still carbon insurance market. So that is the question, as you said, how do you pay out an insurance loss? And I think just widely within insurance, you do often have the option of getting paid out in cash. So for example, if my car is damaged, I might get cash back in order to pay the mechanic to fix it. Or you can get paid out in a kind of like for like. Let's say if my phone is lost or stolen, I might get a replacement phone as my insurance claim. So both of them have precedent within the insurance industry, although cash is generally more common. Within the carbon space, Kita's focus is on enabling flexibility for our clients. And so we can pay out an insurance claim either in cash or in replacement carbon credits. However, how you do this, I think, A, either option is of interest based on why and how a company is engaging in the carbon markets. And then how you pay out in replacement carbon credits has nuance because of the lack of what we term fungibility within the carbon markets. So is a forestry project equal to a biochar project, say? But yes, we can do either. I would say that within the companies that we work with, the companies that have a strong preference for a claim to be repaid in replacement carbon credits tend to be what we would call an end user. So a corporate that is buying carbon credits to retire to meet its net zero strategy, these are often, if they're engaging with Kita, engaging early in the carbon markets in order to lock in supply. And thus, if they fail to receive carbon credits at that future point, they need them and they receive cash, it's not that helpful because they're still faced with that shortage of supply point, which is what they wanted to avoid in the first place. So they tend to be most interested in insurance claims paid in carbon credits. However, if you work more with the financiers or the intermediaries or the banks, they tend to be more interested in cash payouts, in part because some of them are very, very experienced at sourcing carbon credits. And they are more interested, like I said, in sort of taking that risk off their balance sheet so they can deploy more capital. But us paying them out in cash is actually helpful because they're excellent at deploying capital into carbon projects and enables them to do that. From the bank perspective, some of them are looking at capital relief. And thus they need a cash payment, a carbon credit payment wouldn't enable them to get that kind of capital relief on a solvency level that they're looking for. So I think it's varied. And I truly think because the carbon markets are changing so quickly, giving companies that we work with flexibility is the most important thing for us. And I think it's always going to have people wanting one or the other. It's just when you pay in carbon, you need to define upfront what a suitable replacement carbon credit is. So trees for trees, but what if you wanted something like direct air capture credits and there's no supply of direct air capture credits? What's a suitable replacement? That's the defining that you need to work with upfront, and that's where it gets tricky.
Yeah. I'll ask you about the trickiness in a moment. is there, or do you see, let's say, which part do you consider more important in the whole scaling up process of the carbon market? So the part of, do you see more demand from the, like, say, corporate, so end user side, as you described, or from financial bodies overall, like who's looking to ensure their carbon credit needs, so to speak?
Well, I will answer that, though that is from the perspective of Kita, because our insurance is more focused on those early stage carbon projects. Again, like you stated, we see ourselves as an enabler to drive more finance to scale up early stage projects. And so we're often working with the investor or the financier, and often the corporate buyer will be coming in slightly later. So it's not to say that they aren't interested buyers of insurance. It's more just that our insurance to date has been focused in an earlier stage than they often engage. And so I'd say people who approach us tend to be the financiers, the intermediaries who are putting money up front into carbon projects in order to receive the credits. We also speak with a lot of project developers who want to be able to sell an insured credit. And so they want to ease the process for either their investors or their buyers via selling that credit that already has that protection built in. And I'd say, actually, just for example, I spoke to someone today who came from the mining industry. And this is quite common for us to speak to people who have been in other industries where insurance is very established, and for them to be moving to carbon and looking to buy insurance policies that they know and that are familiar. And again, that tends to be insurance that tends to function in a kind of more structured finance transaction where you have an investor who puts money into a project. So it's taking that risk of project failure. That investor is going to receive the carbon credits and they're going to have offtake signed with the end buyers to deliver that carbon, and the end buyer will pay them upon receipt. And in that instance, if it all works well, the investor makes a return. However, it falls down if there is an under-delivery or non-delivery of the credits. Or on the flip side, if the buyer receives the credit but isn't able to pay. And that's where you can get into what you'd call an insurance comprehensive credit policies. But in essence, you're looking at wrapping these risks for the investor to enable them to engage in these projects with as much confidence as they can. And that is really how you free up capital to go into these high-risk projects.
Yeah, I was going to ask just for the sake of understanding again, that you're really in that early part of the market, so to speak, helping early stage carbon companies to build credibility and trust in the market, more or less to get these initial offtake agreements, basically, so that they can finance their initial development, essentially, right? So if I understand right, before a large buyer or like a frontier can come in and actually buy, let's say, significant amount of carbon, you really help that initial scale-up process, not a mature company, so to speak.
Yes, that is exactly right. I will say, I mean, particularly if anyone's listening is going to get in touch, like there is a stage at which you will be too early. So if you think about carbon projects in three high-level buckets, one is your project design phase. You know, it's like you're designing it, but you don't have anything yet. And that leads up to the point of a validation by a carbon standard. You then have the kind of intermediate stage, which is you've been validated. So some third party has audited what you're doing and sort of approved your forecast. And you can now start selling carbon credits, but your performance hasn't yet been verified. So you don't yet have your first issuance, as we'd call it. You're in that kind of operational risk stage. Just can you actually execute to meet your forecast? And then the third stage is your kind of ongoing monitoring and reporting. You're more of a mature company. You have some track record. And now we're looking at, can you continue that? Is there any reason for any invalidation of what you've done? Our focus is probably our sweetest spot is in that middle stage. So a project that has already passed some third party audit barriers, it already has a functional prototype. It has some contracts signed. So for example, if you're a director of capture company, you might already have contracts already signed with your storage partners. So now we're looking at, can you execute against that which you have put in place? That's our favorite bit to be in. We can go earlier as well, but we would do more of a specific policy. So for example, to protect against the abandonment or insolvency. And so I think this is an education point for the market with insurance, because we need you to have enough for us to have something to look at the risk of. If you're so early that you're still at that real like VC backing, getting my early plans together, that's where you can still engage with the insurance industry. But I would suggest that people engage with the insurance industry more to understand the type of data that the insurance industry will need in order to consider insuring you, because that data is also probably going to be similar to what the bank will need to consider giving you a loan. And the earlier you can start planning and structuring your projects to be able to provide that data easily and smoothly, the more likely it is you're going to have that bankable project.
Yeah, no, that clears things up a lot. Thank you so much. You were talking about the trickiness of carbon insurance products, and also how people who want to buy insurance for a carbon product like to or expect sort of a conventional insurance product, as you said, especially if they're from an industry like mining. Could you speak a bit to the differences between, let's say, conventional insurance and how a carbon insurance product is structured? Like, is it the way, do I insure a car the same way I insure a carbon project to simplify things? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to try and think how to answer it, because I know I might have already been too technical. I know not everyone listening to this will know insurance at all. So I think at a high level, what Kita has always thought is we're not here to reinvent how insurance works. We are here to translate existing insurance products into the carbon markets. And the carbon markets are not the first new market that has had insurance introduced. You know, renewables is another example, like solar and wind were created, and then insurance was created for them. and the same exact process was applied. You looked at what is an existing type of insurance policy that functions in this space, let's say a performance guarantee. And then how do we understand the evolving risks, risk profile, location, counterparties, technology, supply chains, et cetera, specific to renewables. And over time, you build those two together. So it's the same thing with the carbon markets. There's a lot of existing insurance policies that can translate over. The trick is understanding the specific risk profiles of the carbon markets that enable the pricing of the insurance, and also dictate the risk appetite of the insurance industry to actually sell insurance at scale. But I'd say one example here, I guess to try and keep it relatively simple, is if you think of a carbon credit as property, then feasibly there is room to look at insurance policies that cover property to look at how carbon credits might be considered a property that is lost, let's say, for example. So you can, that is high level, but that's a simple way of looking at it. Is carbon a property? Is it an asset? Or is it a liability? And if it's property, it suits certain types of insurance policies. If it's a liability, it suits other types of insurance policies. So it's about a lot about translating that which already exists into the carbon markets. I will say, though, there are some risks within carbon that are specific. And probably the best example here is the long-term nature of storage. So obviously, once a ton of carbon dioxide equivalent is stored underground, it's supposed to stay there for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And that within the carbon market would be termed permanence. And we will often get people asking for insurance for permanence, in which case they're looking for insurance for very, very long time frames. And I think this is one where there's a disconnect between the market and the insurance industry, and where there's more education required between the two to see how we can reach a compromise, because insurance can't insure, 100 years. And so how do you compromise between what the carbon markets participants might want is that security of really, really long-term insurance with what the insurance industry can do. So there's a couple things that are very specific, but there are others like political risk insurance, say around the risks of engaging in certain countries. What if there's a civil war, act of terror? Some of them are very translatable.
Yeah. You just mentioned this disconnect, right, between what insurance can do and carbon markets. But you also said that the, let's say, carbon insurance market as a whole is quite nascent, so there are not that many companies active in the space. So, like, I wonder a bit, like, who do you compete with, maybe, or like, what keeps, or is carbon, are carbon markets as such just simply not large enough so that large players like an Allianz, for example, to name a German player, I would even be interested in that. You know what I mean? Like, I just wonder, because, like, to me, it seems that carbon markets are already quite large, and that there's will probably be quite a large need for insurance in the future, right? So that I would deem it an attractive field to be in. So I just wonder, you know, like, what's keeping, or what makes it a good place to found a startup in?
Yes.
Or what keeps the big question. Players out? Sorry, there. Those are
what keeps the big players out. So I guess, I mean, A, you have sort of two carbon markets. So one, you have the compliance markets, which are large. I think it's around, what, 850, 900 billion within the compliance markets, so the emission trading systems. Those markets have had some insurance historically, but they tend to be very specific, I think, regulations per jurisdiction. And so I think some of the complexity has kept insurance companies out of that in the past, but that is a sizable market. And we actually are starting to see some of the larger insurance players move in there. So for example, with that, I know I use the very technical term, comprehensive non-payment policies. However, the voluntary carbon market is by any definition, but particularly for a large insurance company, very small. So if you're looking around 2 billion, however you want to characterize it, maybe there's more investment going in than 2 billion, but sales volumes around 2 billion, that's like one client for a large insurance company. And so I think there has been historically a voluntary carbon market just size, just it's not worth it for them, particularly given the risks are high. However, I do think, and I will brag slightly, I think Kita has had something to do with this. There is increasingly a lot of interest in this space. And so you have both a few other new companies like Kita coming in, where it's just very specific, this is all we do. And you have some more of the larger players who are looking at it, and I'd say sort of towing the waters, looking at doing a couple policies here and there, but maybe not quite yet at the level where they're going to hire and bring in a big team. However, some of them will back companies like us. And I think then overall, I mean, insurance industry is interesting in that you do compete with each other, obviously, but you also need to collaborate with each other. And so going back to my satellite example of earlier, if you do have a really big new risk that nobody can with 100% certainty predict the likelihood of failure of a carbon project because it is just too new, it's unlikely that any one company is going to want to insure a very large project all by itself. The preference for, I think, almost everyone will to be, say, let's say, so there's a £50 million investment. I take 10, you take 10, someone else takes 10. Can we share the risk? It's something that's very common to the insurance industry, and it takes something that on its own is relatively uninsurable, and it splits it down into discrete little bits that each individual insurance company can handle. And so I think with the carbon markets, in order to get insurance at scale, the insurance industry itself actually needs more insurance companies in the space so that we can collaborate and share that risk. And that's how you will scale it up.
Oh, that's actually awesome. I feel at least that it's such a collaborative market, so to speak, actually, where
yeah.
you need several players to be walk hand in hand.
Yeah, 100%.
Natalia, we're coming surely but slowly to an end. And I would just like to ask you one short question. And that is like, how do you, you know, as an insurer, you need your client's trust, right? Otherwise, like, why would I trust you to, you know, insure the product that I kind of, well, lead insurance for? Like, how do you create trust for a company that creates trust, ultimately? You know what I mean?
That's a very good question. I don't think you've ever seen our internal team training materials, but actually talking about how you build trust is like number one on our what we talk about our team with. So I guess, I mean, A, you can't tell people to trust you. You have to demonstrate time and time again that you are trustworthy. And I tend to think the way that we try and do that is actually the collaboration point that I just referenced. We do really believe that this is a market that needs to scale up. And we really do believe that the projects and investors that we work with are essential. And so we go out of our way to try and help people even before they're ready to buy insurance. And I think of that as collaboration. There's a lot of education. There's a lot of just working with people. And I think that for a lot of our clients has helped to build the trust that when they actually then are ready, they do come to us. So I think it's that kind of aligned interest and collaboration. I think it's, we have rules as to how quickly we respond. So respond within 24 hours, always give back something substantive within at least 5 working days. That again, just makes people know that they haven't gone into that kind of black void. And then I think over time, and this is where real trust will build, but over time, as the insurance industry starts to pay out insurance claims in this space, that's when you can really start to point to the evidence of you can trust us, this went wrong, and that we were there for you. I do think that's one of the challenges right now is that there's no track record really of claims at any scale because the market's so new. And so thus for us, it's really around that collaborative approach and always just really excellent client service. So that's how we're trying to do it. And I think today it's been quite successful.
Yeah, sounds great. Natalia, thank you so much for taking the time. And I look forward to Kita to creating more trust in the carbon markets in the future. Thank you so much. And yeah, all the best for the future.
Thank you very much. Same to you.